Is that song really a cover? What instrument are they playing there? What do those crazy lyrics mean? If you're the kind of person who thinks about stuff like that, you're in luck because I've got just the podcast for you. How Good It Is chooses a single song each episode and takes a dive into the story behind the song and the artist who made it famous. I'm Claude Call. You can find me in your favorite podcast software or just point your browser to howgooditis.com. How good it is. Welcome to the second half of our show. Hope you had a relaxing break.
Hope so too. And now we are going to be talking about a movie which, while also about female thieves, is completely different from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Widows. For starters, this one is not a period piece. It's set in the present day. But Claude's going to get into that when he gives us the plot description for Widows.
Yeah, we open up with a series of scenes. It jumps back and forth between a heist taking place in various domestic situations, which introduce us to the main characters. We've got Veronica and Harry Rawlings, who are played respectively by Viola Davis and Liam Neeson. They're a happily married couple. We've got Linda and Carlos Pirelli, who are played by Michelle Rodriguez and Manuel Garcia Rufo. They own a shop and they have a couple of kids, Xavi and Gracie. Now, having said that, it looks like Linda's the one doing all the work to make the business successful there. We have Alice Gunner, who is being physically abused by her husband, Florek. They're played by Elizabeth Debicki and John Bernthal. Now, Florek tries to make up for the abuse by being extra nice to her afterwards, as we see so commonly. And then finally, we see Jimmy Nunn, who is played by Coburn Goss, kissing his wife Amanda goodbye. She's played by Carrie Coon. When the heist is completed, we see the men are being pursued by police after completing it, and it's about that point that we realize that the men we saw in those domestic situations are the ones involved in this crime. They make it to their safe house, but there's a whole squad of cops following them there. And just as the thieves are attempting to exit, the cops start shooting at their car until the van they're in explodes spectacularly, killing all four of them. We jump over to Jack Mulligan, who's played by Colin Farrell, and he's running for the alderman position of the 18th Ward in Chicago. His father, Tom, played by Robert Duvall, is the retiring alderman who hopes his son will follow in his footsteps. Running against Jack is Jamal Manning, who's played by Brian Tyree Henry. Jack visits Jamal's campaign office, which is in a church. On the surface, it's meant to be a meeting about a spirit of cooperation, but it's really a suggestion on Mulligan's part to get Manning to drop out of the race. The women bury their husbands. Veronica attends Harry's funeral, where his remains are laid to rest beside their late son Marcus, and we're going to learn a little bit more about him later. Mulligan is in attendance, and he tells Veronica that he knew Harry very well, so he offers his services to her if she needs him. Jamal and his brother, Jatem, who's played by Daniel Kaluuya, are also there watching the service from afar. Amanda and Alice attend the funerals of their husband. Linda is at home and tries to console Carlos's mother, Lita, but she blames Linda for what happened to Carlos because she claims that he got into that life to support her and the kids, and now his blood is on Linda's hands. Veronica is visited by Jamal, and he tells her that Harry stole $2 million from him, which is money that he needs to fund his campaign. He orders Veronica to come up with the money within 2 weeks. Veronica protests that she knows nothing whatsoever about Harry's business, but Jamal does not care. Linda goes to her shop and she finds men repossessing everything inside. When she demands an explanation, she's told that Carlos was the one who handled the lease on the store, and because he was down on payments to the bookies and the loan sharks, the store no longer belongs to Linda. Meanwhile, Alice's mother, Agnieszka, suggests that she support herself by becoming an escort. Alice is reluctant at first, but then she gives in to the idea. Veronica visits someone over the lewd photos involving a man having sex with a younger woman. It's clearly intended to blackmail him. She then goes to a bowling alley to meet a man named Bobby Welsh, who's played by Kevin J. O'Connor, and he hands her a notebook left by Harry that details all of his heist activities. She's hoping that the notebook might be worth something, but Bobby says it's not likely. Veronica learns that Harry's next heist involves stealing $5 million. At a nearby gymnasium, Jatem's guys find two young men rapping and bring them to Jatem. It turns out that they were responsible for guarding Jamal's money that was stolen. Jatem orders them to start rapping again, and then he executes them. Jack is at a rally for an organization of his called Minority Women of Work, in which he sees that women of color can get their businesses off the ground. He is pressed by one reporter over another less ethical practice of his, and he walks away with his aide, Shoban, who's played by Molly Kunz. As they're being driven away, Jack complains to her about his insecurities about running against Jamal and the pressure being faced by his father, but Shoban tells him, suck it up. Veronica contacts the other three widows and arranges to meet them at a spa. Linda and Alice show up, but Amanda doesn't. Veronica informs the other two about the situation regarding Jamal and how Harry left behind plans for the next job. Linda and Alice reluctantly agree to join when Veronica emphasizes how much of a threat the Mannings are going to be to them and their families. Jamal visits a church to speak to Reverend Wheeler, who's played by John Michael Hill, for an endorsement. Although, Wheeler already appears to be siding with the Mulligans. Jatem visits Bobby at the bowling alley to attack and torture him for information regarding Harry's notebook, which he says he gives to Veronica. He later calls to Veronica and to ask if she sold it, and she lies and says she did. At a nearby hair salon, we have Belle, who's played by Cynthia Erivo. She watches as her boss Bruchel, who's played by Edipero Oduye, she has to give up money to a large man sent by his boss. Belle presses Bruchel for doing so, but she explains later on that she has to give up a cut of her earnings to the ones who allow her to keep the business afloat. And that turns out to be Jack Mulligan. After work, Belle returns home to her mother Suzette and her daughter Bailey, only to get a call about another job, prompting her to leave immediately and rapidly to catch the bus. She arrives at Linda's home to babysit for children. Linda goes to join Veronica and Alice at their husband's old hideout, where Veronica gives them some money to get guns and a getaway van. She also gives them the blueprints for the heist. Alice goes to an auto auction to get a van and ends up paying more money than it's worth. And that's when we realize Alice can't drive, so Veronica has to recruit Harry's old driver, Bash, who's played by Garrett Dillahunt. Allison goes to get guns and she scams a woman into helping her buy guns because she doesn't have the proper documents to purchase firearms. Meanwhile, Linda is trying to figure out the blueprints to the heist, but she can't make out part of the wording on the paper. She visits a man whose house she believes to be the mark by posing as someone working for a company that owns the house, but she slips up when she mentions the man's wife, whom he says has been dead for 4 months. Linda breaks down when she mentions her dead husband. She and the man start kissing before Linda realizes it's wrong, and she leaves. Linda later joins Alice as the two go to a shooting range to practice. Alice does well, but Linda turns out to be a really bad shot. Alice joins the escort company, and she starts seeing a man named David, who's played by Lucas Haas. He turns out to be a real estate executive, and he spots the blueprints in Alice's room, and he identifies them as being part of the Mulligan home. Veronica finally meets with Amanda in a diner. She mentions not being able to meet with Veronica previously due to taking care of her newborn baby. And because of this, Veronica chooses not to mention anything involving the heist. 1 week before the job is to take place, the Mannings visit Bash and they murder him. Veronica finds out and tells the ladies that they need a new driver. Linda notices how fast Belle is, so she invites her to join the heist. Despite Veronica's initial reservations, she agrees to let Belle join them because of her no-nonsense attitude. Veronica goes to Amanda's apartment with her dog Olivia to talk to her, but she's distracted by her baby crying. When she goes to take care of the baby, Olivia goes to a nearby closet and starts barking. Veronica looks over and there's a table next to the closet and she sees a flask on the table and it looks just like the one that belonged to Harry. Veronica walks over to the door and she considers opening it and having what she's thinking confirmed, but instead she grabs the dog and leaves before Amanda comes back out. Amanda goes to the closet and she opens up the door and it's Harry inside. Meanwhile, we have Veronica driving away sobbing. We then get a flashback that shows how Harry set up his guys with a decoy in the driver's seat, and he fired a couple of shots so that police will start shooting at the van just before he set off explosives to obliterate his men. This is interspersed with scenes of Harry on a boat with Jack as we learn they've been working together, and Jack had ordered Harry to steal from Jamal. We get another flashback showing that Harry and Veronica's relationship maybe wasn't so awesome after all, right before the last job. We go back to 2008 and their son Marcus was alive. He was out driving and he did an illegal U-turn to go back home and deliver something to Harry. He was pulled over by a cop and shot to death when Marcus failed to show his hands quickly enough. Harry heard the entire thing over the phone and it essentially broke him. Tom meets with Jack over Jack's firing the campaign manager that's been with their family for 30 years. Tom curses him out and orders him to have Shoban rehire the man, but Jack tells him he can't wait for the day that he doesn't have to talk to Tom anymore, since Tom won't be there. Veronica visits Jack to help for ask for help rather with Jamal, although he tells her there's nothing he can do, and he learned from his father and Harry that you reap what you sow. While Veronica talks to Jack, the other ladies are scoping out the outside area to get a view of external security, and the women also spend some time at the hideout practicing how they're going to move the money around and how fast they need to move. Just before the job takes place, Veronica finds Ken. He's the CEO of the Mulligan Security Company, and he's played by Matt Walsh. He's the man in the lewd photos that she acquired earlier, and it turns out they are pictures of him and his niece. So Ken doesn't have a whole lot of choice in the matter, so he gives Veronica the codes to the Mulligan safe. The ladies then gather for the heist later that evening, which is the night of the political debate between Jack and Jamal. Belle distracts the security guards outside by firing flares into some nearby cars. Veronica, Linda, and Alice get inside with masks and devices that distort their voices. They make it to the safe and they take all the money, but just as they start to move out, Tom comes out of his room with a gun in his hand, and he orders the women to drop their weapons. He unmasks Veronica, and he shoots Alice in the shoulder, wounding her, but Linda shoots and kills Tom. The ladies run out of the house, and they head to the van, only to find that Belle is being held at gunpoint by Jatem, who was sent by Jamal to take all the money. Jatem hijacks the van, but the ladies give chase, and they ram it, causing Jatem to crash the van and die. Linda then takes Alice to the hospital to get her treated for her wound. Veronica drops off Belle, then she goes back to the hideout, only to find Harry there. She's naturally furious at him for his betrayal. He attempts to justify what he did as him having to look out for himself and his new family, that being Amanda and the baby he had with her. Harry tries to kill Veronica, but she shoots him first with the same gun that Linda used to kill Tom. Sobbing, she leaves the gun in Harry's hand and leaves with the money after destroying the van that she arrived in. We move forward to just after the election. Jack won the election by way of sympathy votes for Tom's death. Michelle then goes into her salon and finds a bag of money left behind by Belle. Belle happens to be outside with Bailey, and they're driving off to start a new life together. Alice is planning to start her own business, and Linda is able to buy back the shop with her kids. And in the final scene, Alice goes to a diner to meet a friend, and she sees Veronica sitting at a nearby table. A man then enters and sits with Veronica. She gives him a large sum of her share of the money to the man, so that he can help build a library, and she requests that it be named after Marcus. Afterwards, Veronica follows Alice outside and greets her with a smile, the first time we've seen her do this in the present.
Okay, so this is based on a novel by Linda LaPlante. If you know that name, it's probably because she was the person behind Prime Suspect, which is one of the British TV shows that made it big here in the U.S., or relatively big, and also helped make a star out of Helen Mirren, as she played the main role in that show. And the novel was turned into a miniseries in 1983, which I never saw, but Steve McQueen apparently saw it and was a big fan. So after he made his movie 12 Years a Slave, which did pretty well at the box office, did very well with critics, and won a few Oscars, including Best Picture, he decided to turn that into a movie. And by the way, she's only in the movie very briefly, but Amanda's mother is played by Anne Mitchell, who appeared in the original miniseries playing the character that Viola Davis basically plays in the movie, although in the miniseries as well as in the original novel, that character is named Dolly. And of course, the woman in the miniseries, which again I haven't seen, but also in the movie, are all British women in their 40s and maybe a little older, and they're all white, whereas in this movie, we've got a range of ethnicities and ages. Viola Davis is nearly 60, Michelle Rodriguez is in her 40s, and Elizabeth Debicki, who is Australian, she's in her early 30s, and yet all three of them, you know, work together as people who might be involved with shady characters and gangsters and convince you that, you know, that they could also pull off a robbery like this, which is the most important part of the movie. And again, even though, and we're going to talk about this in a little more detail in a bit, Steve McQueen was known for making art house movies like 12 Years a Slave, and then before that, Hunger, and also Shame, all three of which starred Michael Fassbender in a major role. He takes that art house sensibility and brings it to a genre film like this, a crime film, and he makes it work. What did you think, Claude?
Yeah, it absolutely does work. And actually, I think this was his first film that didn't have Fassbender in it.
Right.
Yeah, but it, he does make it work. He manages to bring these people together. You get a good feel for the relationships between everybody, and he really has managed to put together like a truly engaging heist kind of film, which despite the fact that your main characters are all women, like you could easily slide into, we're talking tropes again, you know, the, like that whole girl power kind of thing. And while you've got some women here like truly, you know, kicking butt and taking names, you know, it doesn't have that weird, silly feel that sometimes you get in films of this nature.
Well, one reason for that is one reason why this is different than most other heist movies or crime movies of this nature. You know, in most heist movies, they're all about the precision of watching people developing the plan, pull off this robbery, and then we see it play out, and then we see the consequences of what happens. But all of that is worked out to the finest detail, whether it's in a dramatic sense, as we saw when we talked about Heat, or in even a comedy like the Ocean's 11 movies or the female spinoff of that, Ocean's 8. This is very different in the fact that although the characters have to plan it out in the tightest detail, the factor that's driving them the most here is desperation.
There's a little bit of that, but there's also this is the plan is already there, right? Like Harry has done everything in that respect. Everything is all laid out. It's all going to happen in this order. So you don't really have to worry about that aspect of it in this particular story. So you do get to focus on these women who really don't know anything about doing this sort of thing, having to develop as, you know, heist masters, as it were. I get, you know, I'm not sure what the correct word is there, but you know, they have to become master thieves over a 2-week period. So you do get these slightly lighter moments of, you know, them screwing up from time to time, where one of them can't shoot and another one can't drive, and like funky little things happen here and there that they have to kind of grow into their position.
No, I know that, but again, they're also coming from desperate circumstances. In addition to the fact that the Mannings all want to kill them, there's also the fact that, as you mentioned, Linda wants to get her business back. Mm-hmm. And Alice basically wants to stand up for herself. And the character played by Cynthia Erivo, Belle, also is seeing what's going on at her hair salon and doesn't want to end up in a situation like that. So that's part of what's new about this movie. Another part that's new about heist movies in general, and also was not in the original novel, although a lot of what's in here is pretty faithful to the novel, except of course the fact that they transplanted it from London to Chicago and changed all the names and had to condense parts of it. Amanda's part was bigger in the novel, and also Belle's equivalent was bigger in the novel as well. But what McQueen and Gillian Flynn, the co-writer, and I'm going to get back to her in a moment, do as well, is add the whole political subplot to the movie, which was not in the original novel, which also adds desperation to what's going on, because here the heist is not taking place in a vacuum, as it were, like it often is in a lot of other movies. It's connected between this alderman's race that is going on. And as we find out, Harry was involved with Jack.
Right.
You know, this whole thing is due to the partnership between the two of them. And you would think that the political side and the crime side might not work together, but McQueen and Flynn do a very good job, I think, of bringing that all together.
Yeah, they do. It actually reminds me, it's a line from, from Godfather Part 2. Don Tomasino says, politics and crime, they're the same thing. And that fits in nicely with the theme here.
Right. Now, again, as we talked about with Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, one of the other aspects of this movie that make it different from other heist movies is the way that it's shot. And I'm thinking of one scene in particular with Jack, and I think it's the scene after he has that rally with the black woman who work, and then he gets into his limousine his assistant, and we hear them talking about things that are relevant to the plot. But what McQueen and cinematographer Sean Babbitt do is they shoot that entire scene from outside the limo. So we see it driving through the neighborhood, and we see it driving from one part of Chicago or the outskirts of Chicago maybe to another. And we see the contrast in the neighborhoods that they're going through. One neighborhood is very poor, where the other neighborhood is very upper class. And that's a nice visual way of showing the themes of the movie as well, the distinctions between the haves and the have-nots, and
the racial difference. Especially in as much as, and if I remember this correctly, the camera starts with, it's basically focused on the passenger side of the car as they get in. And then what happens is, as the car is traveling through the neighborhood from the rally, and it's going back to Jack's house, actually, what happens is the camera slowly starts to move over until basically the windshield is centered, and then finally moves off to the right, so that when the car arrives, it's arriving at Jack's house. And the other thing, I don't know if this was on purpose or it was just like one of those things that just kind of happened, but as they're in Jack's neighborhood, the limo actually blows through a four-way stop sign, so that like is like, hey, I'm untouchable. I can do whatever I want here.
Yeah, I didn't pick that up the first time I saw it, but yeah, that is true. And that's another thing that this movie and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon have in common, is all of these long takes. Mm-hmm. That scene where Jatem is making the guys he shoots rap for him, that's all done with the camera circling around them. And that creates an air of menace that you might not get with the traditional cutting back and forth between the two of them, or at least you wouldn't get it in the same way.
Sure, if nothing else, it sets the viewer a little bit off balance, you know. And even though in this particular, I mean, we've seen the 360s before, and that's kind of what they're intended to do, is make you just a little bit uneasy, a little bit dizzy, a little bit, you know, what's going on here, that kind of thing. This, like, and I'm thinking also of the dance scene in Carrie, where we get the same thing, except that's kind of accelerated because they're dancing on a platform which is spinning one way and the camera is actually going the other way, and it just keeps speeding up until you get to the end of that shot. But in this particular case, everything's at eye level pretty much, and we're moving around and around and around as this conversation takes place. And so you've got the tension of the conversation and the guys trying to rap under this pressure, and Jatem is like kind of leaning into their faces as the camera gets to a point where he can do that. So, you know, everybody's kind of off balance. And then finally, bang goes the one. And then he tells the other one to run away. And bang goes the other guy.
Right. Now, we should talk about Daniel Kaluuya a moment. The only other thing I had seen with him in it up to that point was Get Out, where he plays the hero of the movie. So to see him go from that being the guy who has no idea what's going on, finding himself trapped in this nightmare, going to playing this really scary villain, and yet not in a stereotypical way, just shows the great range that he has here. Now, another thing that this movie has in common with Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is that one of the main roles in both movies was originally going to star someone else, but then that someone else had dropped out for whatever reason. In Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Jen was originally going to be played by Shu Qi, who, as we've talked about before, played the lead in So Close. But apparently her agent insisted that she do this soft drink commercial instead, and that's how Ji Yi Zhang got cast in the part. Supposedly, after that, Shu Qi dropped that agent and hired a new one, and who could blame her? And for this movie, Jennifer Lawrence was originally cast as Alice. And while I think she would have done very well in the part, for whatever reason, she had to drop out, and Elizabeth Debicki took on the part instead. Now, Debicki started out, or at least she came to my attention, appearing in Baz Luhrmann's adaptation of The Great Gatsby. And quite frankly, she's one of the only good things about that movie for me. And then she also did very well playing, even though her part was cut down from the novel, she's also does a very good job playing the villain, or one of the villains, in the Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie that Guy Ritchie directed. Even though I wasn't crazy about that movie either, she was, for me, the best part of the movie. But ever since those, it seems like she's made her specialty playing people who are emotionally fragile and then eventually find that inner toughness that allows them to go on, like she did in the miniseries adaptation of The Night Manager. And then also in Christopher Nolan's last movie, Tenet, where she plays another trophy wife, this time to Kenneth Branagh. She played a trophy wife in that Night Manager as well, to Hugh Laurie. And although that might seem like she's getting into a stereotype, in all three of those performances, she makes it convincing. And here she handles it well, whether she's doing scenes with Viola Davis, or because in both the novel and the movie, Alice and Veronica, or the equivalent, both the novel and the movie, Alice and Veronica, or their equivalent characters in the novel, are the ones who are at most at odds here, because Veronica feels that Alice is a load because she can't drive, whereas Alice believes that Veronica is much too bossy. But they end up bonding together, not shown as much here in the movie as it is in the novel. But anyway, Debicki handles herself well with Davis, with in the scenes with her, and then also with her mother, who, by the way, is played by Jackie Weaver, who you might remember from the Australian crime drama Animal Kingdom, where she plays the matriarch from hell. Here she's playing more of a traditional mother who is not great for her daughter, but does have some redeeming qualities about her. The only problem with the two of them is that Debicki is much taller than Weaver, which is why all their scenes together pretty much have the two of them sitting down. But she works well with that. And Debicki also pulls off scenes like when she convinces the woman at the gun show to buy guns for her. You know, she pretends she's running away from an abusive relationship. And since we see that she's been involved with an abusive relationship, she's convincing and selling that. And then also the scenes that she has with Lucas Haas are played very well. So she, as I said, even though she's playing a familiar character to, or a similar character that she's played before, I think she does it very well.
She does a good job. Jennifer Lawrence would have done a good job too, I think, but I think also that she would conceivably have been a distraction, because here's the thing with this particular film is Liam Neeson gets blown up at the beginning of the movie. And I was like, why would they only have him in this movie for a couple of minutes? It doesn't make sense to me. And so we're either going to see him in a lot of flashbacks or there's something else going on, you know? And I frankly went with, we're going to see flashback. And so the reveal of, you know, his treachery here was actually a pretty good one. But it was the same kind of thing is like everybody else is like, while they're known, you know, they're not really well known. They're not big, big names. Jennifer Lawrence was kind of a big name at that point. And I think she really would have kind of outweighed the others in this film. And so that the fact that you had all these actresses who are on more or less equal footing career-wise, you know, it goes a long way toward making them build up as equals within the team. Does that make sense?
Well, yes, although I do want to point out that Michelle Rodriguez had been in some pretty big box office movies with the Fast and Furious movies, although she wasn't the main star of all of them. She was more of a supporting role.
Right, and that's kind of where everybody else was. Like Viola Davis had been in like a million movies at that point, but she was never like this far up in the forefront before, you know? So it was really the same kind of thing. Is we know who she is. We know she's a good actress. She does this. She's done all these supporting type things. Now we're pushing her up front.
Okay. Well, I do want to talk about the Davis in more detail in a moment. But first, mm-hmm. I want to get back to Rodriguez. As I mentioned, she's mostly known for action movies, mm-hmm. like the Fast and Furious movies. But this movie is a reminder that when she gets asked, she is capable of good dramatic work. She showed that in her breakout movie, Girl Fight, where she played the main character. I don't know if you saw that one, but she reminded me of a young Marlon Brando there. She was really good. And then in Battle in Seattle, she plays an activist, and she's very good in that. And in a movie I was talking about with a Facebook friend earlier today, Avatar, she is playing an action oriented part in that movie, in that she's playing a soldier. But in that movie, you know, she goes from working for the government side to wanting to help the rebels. And she's got this line where she said, "This ain't what I signed up for, screw that," or words to that effect. And she makes it work. And she makes the dramatic scenes work well here, especially the scene where she goes over to the guy's house and starts trying to tell him the story, and then she flubs up, and they end up kissing, and then she realizes it's the wrong thing. She carries all of that very well, I think.
Yeah, you know, you realize also that when she starts to break down, like she realizes she's made her mistake, she confesses to him about her husband dying 2 weeks earlier, and then she starts to cry, and you don't take it as a feint on her part that she's just trying to scam this guy into giving up whatever she wants out of him. You know, she is genuinely upset and crying. It's like it's finally really struck her that this has happened and that she's suddenly dealing with it. And you know, the fact that she has done the wrong thing in trying to capitalize on what she didn't realize was this guy's pain going on, and that her mistake has kind of compounded it. And you know, that she first like kind of collapses into herself, and he does this like a little there, pat on the back kind of thing. And she actually kind of leans into him a little bit. And then it turns into it actually has this very natural development, and she does it so, so well. And then finally she realizes, oh my God, what am I doing? And she bolts out of there.
Right. Now let's jump to Davis. As you mentioned, she was in a lot of supporting parts, including in a movie that we talked about before people sort of knew who she was, Out of Sight. Mm-hmm. You know, she's got that one scene playing Don Cheadle's girlfriend, and she makes an impression there. And you'd see her in a lot of these one scene or one sequence roles where she made a big impression, you know, in Traffic, where she's playing a counselor, in Syriana, where she plays a government official grilling George Clooney's character, and then, of course, in Doubt, where in the best scene in the movie, in my opinion, where Meryl Streep's character is talking to her about the possibility of a priest molesting her son. And she is only in that one scene and gives what I think is the best performance in the movie by far. This was her first lead role. Mm-hmm. And she attacks it with gusto, and she's convincing in the physical, obviously in the dramatic elements, of course, and then also the physical aspects of it. And one thing that I didn't really think of until I saw this on the IMDb trivia page, the fact that she got to use her natural hair for the first time in a Hollywood movie that she did.
Wow.
That McQueen, you know, when she first reported to the job, she asked McQueen what kind of wig he wanted her to wear, and he said, none at all. And she said, that's according to her trivia page, that's when she knew this was going to be a good shoot for her. But she is very good in this lead role. This may not be her best performance, but it's one of them.
Yeah, she comes off as very cold and very dry. And you know, there are discussions with the other women where they're talking the same way. It is like, you know, she really needs to get this stick out of her butt and that kind of thing. But it also has a little bit more impact when, just like Julien in our last half of the show, is when she finally breaks and shows that emotion at the end, it's visually satisfying for us, you know, where she, you know, it could be where she looks over there and doesn't say anything to Alice, or, you know, just, you know, hi and that's it and let's run away and whatever happens to me. No, she actually greets her. How have you been? You know, it's a very warm kind of thing. And it's the same thing like Julien just suddenly breaking down and crying. Is like you finally get the emotion out of her. And that's why I mentioned it in my synopsis, was it's the first time we've seen her do it in the present, because we've seen it a couple of times in flashback. But ever since Harry died, she's always been this angry, upset, crying, whatever it happens to be. It's never a positive emotion, really.
Right. Now, the one other name that I want to mention here, Colin Farrell is very good here, as is Robert Duvall, even though it's a small role. The one other name I want to talk about here is Gillian Flynn. Full disclosure, I actually met her once at a party, but she at that time that I met her was the TV critic for Entertainment Weekly, and then she became a novelist and a screenwriter. Arguably, the most well-known thing she wrote was the first novel that was filmed, Gone Girl, which was directed by David Fincher. And that movie is one that I admired more than I liked. But here, I think she and McQueen do a good job with making this both a character piece as well as a plot-driven piece, with all the strands of plot and theme being brought together, so that even though there's quite a lot of material packed into a 129-minute movie, it never feels rushed.
No, it does not. It's got a nice balance of the tension, and every once in a while they break it with a little bit of humor and suspense, and you know, even a little bit of action here and there. It's a very well constructed story.
Right. So do you have anything else that you want to add before we wrap this up?
No, both of these films were a hoot, let me tell you what. I had a lot of fun watching. That's all.
Okay. So while both of these movies are available on regular DVD, if you prefer to stream them, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is available to stream through Amazon Prime as well as HBO Max and AHA. And they're also is also available to rent or buy through most of the usual streaming services like Amazon or Google Play or Yahoo. Whereas Widows is available to stream if you subscribe to Fubo or DirecTV, but is also available to rent or buy through Amazon, Apple TV, and more of the usual streaming services.
Cool. And what's going on next time around?
Well, next episode, we're going to talk about television. Well, specifically, we're going to talk about movies that, quote unquote, inspired TV shows that weren't directly based on them, but had enough of a similarity to them that you could understandably be confused about that fact. And those movies are from 1953, Stalag 17, directed and co-written by Billy Wilder, and from 1992, Singles, written and directed by Cameron Crowe. And both movies are available on DVD, but if you prefer to stream, Stalag 17 can be streamed through the Roku channel or Tubi if you're willing to put up with the ads.
It's also available on Canopy, I just learned.
Oh, that's good. If you have access to that through your library, your local library, or you could rent or stream it through Amazon, Apple TV, and most of the usual suspects there. As far as Singles goes, it's available to rent or buy through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, and most of the other usual suspects. And as far as we go, our show has a Facebook page and a Twitter feed that you can always comment on, or if you have a question or comment, you could also email us. Our email address is wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. You can also find myself, Sean Gallagher, on Facebook. And how about you, Claude?
You can find me on the Twitter machine at Claude Call. You can also check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to us, and we hope to see you next time.
Thank you so much. Rebecca, take us away.
This is your announcer, Rebecca Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Anchor.fm. If you want to support the show, go to anchor.fm/wordsandmovies and click on the support link. Who knows? Maybe they'll even kick a few bucks my way. Thanks for listening.